This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at IntesaCom.com. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of Downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
That they'll just go their separate ways.
That bygones become.
But they also, but he also, yeah, exactly. That is the saying. By bomb, bomb, bomb.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO, editor-in-chief at Voice San Diego. I'm joined, as always, by managing editor Andrew Keats. What's up, Andy?
Scott, how you doing, pal?
Pretty well, thank you. And co-managing editor, Andrea Lopez Villafana is here. Hello, Andrea.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm very well, thank you. Coming up on the show today, lots of people have asked us why San Diego County vaccination rate data does not match up with what's shown on the New York Times website and other trackers that come from the CDC. We'll tell you why. Mayor Todd Gloria criticized his predecessor for, quote, criminalizing the unsheltered. And he suggested that when he became mayor, significant change would come on his watch. Well, our reporter Lisa Alverstadt checked in on those efforts and found that police are continuing to ticket homeless residents of San Diego, even when they accept offers of shelter. But the beds to shelter them aren't available. And a longtime leader of the Union of Unions, the San Diego Building and Construction Trades Council, announced his retirement last week. That was a big local news story in itself. But then Andy revealed that his employer had discovered 5 years of what they called, quote, unintended compensation. We'll break that down and more. And finally, the best of PolitiFest. Each of us have picked some of our favorite moments so far from this week's conversations. That's all coming up. Stay with us. I cannot tell you guys how many times somebody has asked me this over the last few weeks. I always talk. I have a pretty regular thing on social media where I'll print or I'll show all the data, COVID data, vaccination rates, stuff like that. And people always bring up to me, why are the numbers different that the county of San Diego is putting out compared to the New York Times? Here, for example, the county of San Diego says 80.5% of eligible San Diego County residents have gotten fully vaccinated from COVID-19, and 89.7% of them have gotten at least one shot, 90% almost. But the New York Times says that 51% of people here have gotten fully vaccinated, and they get that number from the CDC that also says 51% of San Diegans are fully vaccinated. However, they also say that 99.9% of people here have had one shot.
Yeah, the story that's being told by that data is a wild. It's like, what the heck is going on in San Diego? Virtually everyone has one shot, but only half of the people followed up to get two.
Yeah, and this has been their data has been tracking on the front page of the New York Times since the beginning of the pandemic. And, you know, as we're like talking with friends and stuff, I'll be like, oh, San Diego's doing really good. And they're like, what are you talking about? 51%? That's not good.
Yeah.
It's, what's the deal?
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting if the data was just...
Oh, no, we killed Andrea.
What are you talking about?
Your impression of your friend, Godfrey. Why does your friend talk like that anyway?
Yeah. I don't know.
It's the difference between like being good and bad. It's not just a small like, oh, that's weird. The data's different.
Right, just a little bit.
But they basically tell the same story. It's a wild difference, right?
All right. Andrea, as editor, managing editor, Daily News, our Megan Wood looked into this. She figured out what happened or what's wrong, and what is it?
Okay, so basically the county takes its data, puts it to this aggregator, and then the CDC gets the data there. And that's where something happens, where the data gets mixed up and they know it's wrong, but...
Okay, let's start on that point real quick.
Yeah.
They know it's wrong.
They know it's wrong.
They admit it's wrong.
Yes.
The CDC, which publishes this data that is distributed by the largest newspaper in the United States with its website that reaches tens of millions of people per day, is distributing information that they know is wrong, that the CDC knows is wrong.
Yes. They know it's wrong.
That's crazy.
And they were quite matter-of-fact about it.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't seem alarmed.
No. It's like, yeah, it's wrong. There's something that happens in between from when the county puts its data to when we get it, and it's wrong.
And we might fix it.
Yeah.
But they don't seem in a tremendous hurry to do so.
We're super concerned of like what having this wrong data could do to the public's understanding of what's going on in San Diego.
Or to their understanding. If they're talking to the president, for example, of the United States, and they're like, and he's like, hey, how are things going, guys? And they're like, well, sir, it's going well. We have all these places that are vaccinating really well. I don't know about San Diego County, though. They're only 51%. And he's like, wow, well, maybe we should do something about that because that's an important part of our country. Seems like something they want to get right.
Think anybody would think this is an important part of the country. Our senators don't even come here.
They will. I think they will.
Okay.
Yeah. Because of this, probably. Like, what's going on down there?
So did the county have any insight about what was going on?
That the county's numbers are correct. Mm-hmm. And, after our deadline, they did say that it's important to have accurate data.
They held
but
that.
That was pretty much it. So,
okay. Yeah. We agree.
Yeah.
Do we need to send a note to New York Times and say like, hey, you might want to put an asterisk that the CDC says this isn't correct?
Yeah. I mean, what else is going on with their data? Like,
yeah, what
I'm mean, just not going to use that portal for information anymore.
One of the things about the New York Times is if they put out information, you can say like, well, look, if they're wrong, they'll correct it. So I'm going to go ahead and go with it for a while.
Yeah.
That's the definition of a reputable news organization, right? That like they were willing to correct.
Yes.
So hopefully this gets ironed out.
Yeah. Well, I guess it makes me think like if that's what's happening here in San Diego, is that happening in other counties or is it just us?
Yeah, because they could miss in either direction for all kinds of different places.
Well, it appears they have. They said that literally everyone except for one guy has gotten the shot.
Yeah, yes.
And that one guy is like, well, I think there's others. It's probably safe to say that in San Diego, there was one progressive leader that had a pretty disproportionate impact on local public policy. That is Tom Lemon. He led the Building Trades Council. So this is a union of unions. So there's all kinds of unions like the laborers, the electrical workers, all of these groups that are part of the Building Trades Council, correct?
Correct.
And he
Which
was...
Which is different than the San Diego Imperial County's Labor Council.
Right, which is also a union of unions.
Right.
That
of which the building trades is a part.
Right.
As are its component unions.
Right.
Umbrellas above umbrellas.
Lots of umbrellas. So after Mickey Kasparian, the former leader of the Labor Council and the United Food and Commercial Workers, when he left town, there was basically one big personality. There's a few. But a big one was Tom Lemon.
Yeah.
Tom Lemon. everywhere. There was a big public decision, stadiums in Mission Valley, resorts, discussions about affordable housing. He was there.
Right.
And he was there in a big way. Like he
elections he had, for you know, city council races, mayoral races.
You might remember a podcast episode we did 3 years ago where in the middle of this debate and discussion about whether to put a tax increase up on the ballot to expand the convention center, he threw up his hands and in a public meeting said, "This is a shit show."
Yeah.
And it really was. It was a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Well, he retired last week, announced his retirement, and it was accompanied with tremendous outpouring of support for him and other things that came out. But then, Andy, you broke the news that that retirement, which was effective immediately.
Mm-hmm. Which is uncommon for these sorts of things.
Little uncommon. Had been part of a discussion that the building trades was having with him, which was?
Basically, I obtained a document that is a resignation agreement between Tom Lemon and the Building Trades Council that says that a committee within the Building Trades Council had been created to look through and audit executive compensation over the last 5 years. And that committee in its review discovered, quote unquote, unintended compensation that had been going to Tom Lemon in the amount of, I don't exactly know why, this number is not known specifically. I only have what's in the document, but between $20,000 and most likely $40,000 per year that he should not have been receiving, that he was receiving.
Over 5 years.
So somewhere between $100,000 and $200,000 that he had received improperly.
Right. So he is an employee of the Building Trades Council, and part of its revenue comes not just from its members, but also from an affordable housing complex that they own in National City.
Yes, and so his salary is split between those entities. He gets paid both by the nonprofit shell that owns the affordable housing complex in National City, and then also from the union itself, which receives dues from all of the union members.
They had an explanation for this. They said that it was a clerical error.
Yeah.
And that when it was discovered, they decided that they needed to tie up this sort of loose thread.
Yes, that is what they said. And so they basically tried to suggest that this was that was all that happened here. But there's indications in the resignation agreement that that's not the case. What the resignation agreement stipulates is that he would resign effective immediately. As of October 13th, and he did announce his retirement the next day. It also stipulates that the union would defer to him in announcing his retirement, and he would be able to do that on his own, which is exactly what happened. It also stipulates that he will not have to pay that money back, that he will sign this agreement. They will waive any claim to recouping that money. And that they'll just go their separate ways. But they also say that he cannot enter any building trades property at all for any reason at any time. But that in 6 months he would be able to go to public events at a community event space that is on the property of the affordable housing spot.
That was the most startling detail that we kind of noticed, which was that indicated a hostility and a suspicion that doesn't comport with the idea that this is an innocent mistake.
Right.
That they're just trying to like make sure is cleared up.
Yeah. And so they specify in the agreement that this is why he's leaving.
Mm-hmm.
This is the reason that he is departing. And that they are settling all of these claims, that there's a settlement over this disputed money. Because they don't want to have a fractious relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're leaving it at that, basically. But it says that both sides now agree he did not deserve that money. And it was about $100,000 to $200,000.
Or that it wasn't part of his compensation.
Yes.
They actually argue in the piece that because of his service, that he doesn't need to repay it or something, right?
They said that I think after finding this money, that they launched a review about whether had he received this money, whether that would have been in line with what he deserved given his work. And they find that they think arguably it would have been okay. Now, that question, though, is like, what's appropriate level of executive compensation? That's pretty wide.
Yeah.
You know, like you could make, I'm sure you could make plenty of cases that he was, that somebody, is, this person or that person is underpaid and that given a $40,000 raise might be appropriate. Problem is, it doesn't seem like he was given a $40,000 raise.
Yeah, usually you do that before you get the raise.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, so I think it helps to put some of this in context. Again, we talked about like he is answerable to the unions and their members.
Yeah.
And to this affordable housing complex. So this isn't like, you know, some big corporate profits or something. These are working people's dollars.
Working people's dollars, exactly right. Yeah. And you know, since the story's come out last week, there was an outpouring, as you say, of support for what he had accomplished. And he, you know, it would be useful context. He did usher in a period of a different perspective within organized labor and its relationship with public affairs. This sort of agreement that unions that work in different fields would be aligned with one another on major policy decisions where their solidarity might win them both benefits.
Yeah, I think it behooves us to look back. When I started covering local politics 2003-04 here, organized labor was a voice, but it was a voice among the business community in many ways.
The business community would often divide and conquer by giving some unions what they were looking for and other unions not, and then there you didn't have a solidified labor force that was a rival faction of the business.
Right. Lorena Gonzalez becomes the leader of the labor council and changes the dynamic, makes it much more politically significant of an entity, of a coalition. It becomes more active in politics. And I think Lemon, and to some extent several other leaders, took that even further and started to make sure that they were the say. They were the most important say because of the political support they had built. And because of their solidarity with other unions, they were the say on so many of these types of projects that, like, you just had to figure out how to make it work. So if he decided he wanted to expand the convention center, well, make sure that the hotel workers are taken care of, that they get what they need out of it. Make sure that the stage workers are taken care of, that they, and then the construction workers as well. And so there are some rivalries, obviously, within organized labor, but he definitely maneuvered it to get people elected and to get influence on these decisions. I think it's fair to say he was, you know, top two or three most influential political leaders in San Diego.
I think that's true. And I think that's consistent with the reception that he received when he announced his retirement last week.
That added to it, he's a big, fun, affable guy, right? Okay. Like there's a charisma around him.
Yeah. And so where last week his retirement announcement received plaudits from people saying what his legacy was and what he had done. The story on Monday after it was published was greeted with a deafening silence, I would say.
Yeah.
And I mean that not even in terms of pushback. You'll notice often a story like this that is critical of somebody or that reveals something that potentially is negative of somebody, you'll see quite a bit of public pushback. There has been no public pushback. There's been no public anything from any of the people who have been associated with him. There's just been complete silence, even just a few days after they were talking about what he had accomplished in San Diego. This time it's the story publishes and it's sort of just a large community of people trying to treat it all like a silent fart.
Well, when it does bring up a question.
Because it smells, but no, if you don't acknowledge it, everybody just deals with that individually.
Yeah.
I get it.
There is a question after this, though. What happens now? Like, who leads the coalition? I think we're all like kind of waiting to see because these positions can be really powerful. They can make a difference. Or they can just be part of a broader, it depends on a lot of who takes them and what they want to do with it.
Yeah, I think like the way I think of it is when we when I first started writing about labor, a bit of pushback I would receive often was labor is not a monolith.
Right.
You need to acknowledge that there's disagreements within labor, that mm-hmm. there's messy democracy within labor.
Some very intense ones, by the way. Yes.
Yes. And part of that is that certain positions rise and fall in stature depending on who holds them. Mm-hmm. And so while replacing Tom might be a very high profile position for whoever takes it, it may also be that he just leaves a vacuum and somebody else doesn't step into that role, but raises their stature in whatever role they're already in,
yeah.
based on whatever local they lead. And that becomes a position of authority or yeah, influence.
Like, for instance, one of the rivals is on his own board, right?
Yes.
Right. Val Macedo, who runs the laborers union, they want to get more into things that might compete with electricians and electrical workers. And so that kind of competition is going to be dramatically changed, it seems.
And he wouldn't necessarily need to take over for Tom to take over exactly. the influential role that Tom had.
Got it. Right. I think it's fair to say that one of the biggest questions in San Diego right now is what is going to happen to homelessness and when. Is this just a thing that we're comfortable with as a society, that these encampments continue, that we have to see and deal with poverty like this, suffering like this, just so plain and nothing changes over time, and how and when will that ever change? And I think the race for mayor a year and a half ago was a big part, a discussion about that. What is going to happen? Todd Gloria was running for mayor, and one of his big things was that this policy that Mayor Kevin Faulkner was carrying out, where you kind of try to beef up the shelters and tents that were available legally for people to go to, and then you push them away and, you know, sweep them out of their encampments that they're building on the street, that's the right approach. That's kind of I think we even called it the Faulkner Doctrine, right?
With the threat of law enforcement.
Right.
That you
literal cops doing it.
You do two things at once. You provide places to go that are not homes, but they are beds that would get somebody off the street, and you force them to take those beds with the threat of being cited for something like encroachment, which is not a crime. We're not talking about police officers targeting homeless people for stealing things or for buying or selling drugs. You're talking about literally enforcing the fact that they're sleeping on a sidewalk.
And using that as a way to talk about,
as leverage to push them into a shelter.
Or to investigate them for other crimes, right?
Yes, right.
And so that was what the former mayor was doing. There is a lot of pressure, has been a lot of pressure on the new mayor to continue to do that. We did not know how we'd come down. We had a conversation about this on the podcast several months ago after a lot of people died under that underpass mm-hmm. when a car ran into them and their encampment, a driver. And so I'm curious. So we were, sorry, So the question has been, what is the mayor going to do? Is he going to continue that, or is he going to change that? And it appears he is continuing it, Andrea. Lisa Halverstad did a piece this week where she took the data about these enforcement actions and compared it to what was happening. And he's doing a little bit less of it, but it's also ramped up quite a bit over the last few weeks and months. And Gloria himself, along with the person he put in charge of addressing homelessness, are not backing away from the idea that this sort of approach needs to continue. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And I guess one thing that I, you know, really stood out from Lisa's story was that they're continuing to give people tickets, but this is even if there are no shelter beds available.
Yeah. To put context on that, we made a deal with people who sued the city, as in the city made a deal.
Not us.
Yeah.
Not the three of us.
That they wouldn't ticket people for this sort of unlawful lodging if there were no beds for them to go to. That's changed?
Yeah. Basically, yes. I guess they would offer them shelter or services, right? And if they decided not to take them, then or not go to a shelter, then they could get a ticket. But in this case, they're offering them shelter, but there is nowhere for them to go, and they still get a ticket.
Wow.
Which is in violation of the settlement agreement and arguably in violation of the law. Like, it's obvious, arguably cruel punishment to ticket somebody for being on the street when there's nowhere for them to go.
Andy, Lisa does a good job of these stories not just being at that high level of policy and mayors and lobbyists talking, but actually going, talking to homeless residents and asking them what they think about all this. They have perceived an increase in enforcement.
Yeah, they perceived an increase in enforcement and a recent one.
Mm-hmm.
There were people who said nothing's changed. This is the same thing we've been living with for a long time. There were others who said this is the same thing we've been living with for a while, and very recently things seem to have ramped up. And the numbers supported that. So basically what Lisa found in talking to homeless people, in talking to the mayor's office, in talking to STPD, and in getting data from the city, is the mayor's office has continued to cite and arrest people for crimes associated with being homeless in the same way that his predecessor did. They are doing less of it, but they are still very clearly doing it still.
Yeah.
And also in August, those activities spiked.
Mm-hmm.
So not only has he continued doing it, they seem to have especially increased doing it starting in August. So in recent months, the decision to enforce homelessness using police presence has become more pronounced.
There was, in the article, we talked to police and others about why that was happening, what they were doing, and they cited two, I think, distinct and interesting points. One was a ramp up of complaints that they were responding to. Obviously, you don't need to be, you know, that plugged in to hear about complaints about these encampments. But then second was they were trying to, they say, address the concern about public health, about the potential for diseases to spread and others. And so Gloria himself, she asked Gloria, the mayor, to talk about why he was doing this. He says, look, we're trying to be more compassionate, more connections to services, more certainty, more humanity behind these interactions. But it's important to acknowledge that we are a city of laws and homelessness is not a crime, but it's also not a get out of jail free card. And we do have responsibilities to enforce the law. So that was a significant quote.
It is a significant quote. It's also a far cry from what he said on the campaign trail. And keep in mind, on the campaign trail, he was distinguishing himself not just from his predecessor, but from his opponent,
yes,
who had a very different perspective on this. He was...
Did she want to be more hawkish on the streets?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah. And so he has... He was the left alternative to both of the...
Compassionate alternative.
At the time. And he's now pulled in two different directions, and he's really just tried to land right in the middle of continuing to do enforcement, but to do less of it.
So I remember going back to, what was it, about a year ago when we did do that discussion about the people who had perished underneath that underpass. And he had went to that scene and he had said something to the effect of, this is not acceptable. We cannot have people living like this. And when we tried to press him, he backed off from the idea that he was saying like he would enforce.
Right.
But it seems like he would.
Yeah, I mean, my perspective, what I'm seeing is he's having a really hard time squaring his rhetoric with what he wants to do. And he's coming into this uncomfortable gray area where you continue to use police as enforcement against homelessness. You do it less than your predecessor, but you can keep doing it. And you try to couple it with some compassionate responses that are non-police in nature.
Yeah.
And I think the risk is it ends up making no one happy.
Exactly. There is very clearly two frames on this. There's the one that says there's a pretty significant, seems like, powerful political coalition or just group of people who are like, this is intolerable. We need to find safe places for these folks to go, and they need to get off the street. They cannot have these encampments build up. And then there's another fierce sort of activist base that's like, you cannot solve homelessness by pushing them around like this. There needs to be more permanent, better, more attractive places for them to go because they don't want to go to those shelters. And those are very different perspectives.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Lisa quoted a couple activists in her piece, but I remember even a couple weeks ago, right, when they were doing some of the cleanups, like a lot of activists were really upset on social media. And, you know, it was around that same time that video came out. And they were like, why are you acting like you've solved homelessness or have you done anything? Because you're still doing the same thing.
Yeah, you're talking about the parody video he did for the Downtown Partnership, one of the groups that really wants to see these encampments not settle in, especially downtown. And yet, you know, what happens? I think, and I get back to like, I really do think, you know, if I was out, if I had to deal with a circumstance like that, I think I would prefer to be in an encampment with friends who I felt comfortable with, as opposed to some of these shelters. I'm not sure that they are very attractive places. Are we really providing alternatives that are more attractive than that setting? I'm not sure we are.
Yeah, I'm not sure we are either. Another thought I've had on this is that the sort of the Goldilocks approach that he has settled on here is, if you have followed Todd Gloria's political career, is very consistent with who he is.
A little of this, little of that.
Yeah. And it does, it has driven, it has been successful for him in some ways, and it has also driven some people crazy and why he has some detractors. But it is, in any case, consistent with who he has been politically. And I wonder if he's starting to realize that that is an easier thing to do as a legislator than it is as an executive. Because in fact, as an executive, you have to choose something. You're not just signaling your position on a bill. You're actually enacting something. And when your proactive decision is to keep doing the thing that you said was cruel, but to just do less of the cruel thing.
One of the things I have a question about, like, is this all was preceded by a giant push of outreach to get people into homes or into shelters or better circumstances. And they touted a tremendous amount of success from it.
A few months ago.
And then they stopped. Like, why aren't they doing that all the time? What, every single dollar that we spend on any issue related should be going to that if it's working at that level.
Right.
All right. So we are going to have a big conversation about this for the final night of PolitiFest. That's Friday night. If you got this in your feed Friday, you still got time. Go to politifest.org, voicesandiego.org/politifest. Lisa has some of the activists involved and police representatives who are going to talk about the role of police officers in this issue, on the streets with homelessness. It's going to be a great discussion. We have had conversations all week this week about law and justice for the PolitiFest event. Every night, a good discussion. After we record this, I'm going to do the sheriff's debate, so that hopefully came out well when you hear this. But we're going to talk about what we enjoyed or appreciated of the 3 days so far. Stay with us. We've had 3 nights now of conversations related to law and justice for the PolitiFest program this week, along with these articles we've been talking about on the site. Very good job, dudes. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have each picked a clip from, or a couple clips from, the sessions. And so we're going to go through what we found most interesting about that. So I watched and was interested in the conversation on Monday about surveillance technology. So in particular, it focused a lot on the City of San Diego's Smart Streetlights program. And so this first clip is from Eric Caldwell. He was the former Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of San Diego and Deputy Chief Operating Officer. And he helped oversee these smart streetlights in the program for what it was. So let me see if I got this right. The city basically allowed a company to retrofit all of our streetlights, and in large part based on the argument that the sensors they were putting in could help the city do all kinds of things to lower pollution, to make streets more efficient.
To monitor pollution.
Right.
To eventually that there would be all these applications about we would need less parking because this would be able to create a system where we knew when parking spaces were open and that you would be able to, somebody, programmer could write an app that would tap into these cameras and find where all the empty parking spaces were, and maybe we could do some traffic monitoring, and it was a real techno-utopia.
Yeah, so Eric Caldwell was deep involved in that at the City of San Diego, and I found him quite candid and interesting to listen to in this panel. Here was his point in answer to the question about why all of this technology ended up just being surveillance for police. That's literally the only use
that they actually ever deployed. There was all these discussions about what might happen once we got these in. None of those things happened. What we did get was cameras that were recorded and then used by police officers to see what it happened.
So it felt a little bit like a bait and switch. Here was his point about that.
Even though it wasn't the intended use case, and I definitely think there was a failure of imagination on behalf of many people at the city as relates to that it couldn't become or wouldn't become the eventual principal use case of the technology. When it was launched, that was very, very clearly not what was intended. But again, I think it's very important for cities to realize is that, you know, we think of cities as these individual departments that are all discrete functions, but in reality, it's one entity. So as you're thinking about surveillance technology, I think it's very important to think about it in the context of if it can be used for a purpose, especially law enforcement, you have to almost make the assumption that it will be. And to not do so is a failure of imagination.
The other part is that not only is it a failure of the imagination not to imagine that it would be used this way, it's like it's an overly active imagination to think it's really going to be used in the ways it was otherwise being promised. Like, in reality, those were fantastical, that these other use cases would be really beneficial. That was wishful thinking. There was, in fact, a much more practical, immediate application for it. And of course, that's how it was ended up.
And yet it was never discussed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was wild.
I would have liked to know where parking was available. Dang, that would have been cool.
Yeah. All right. So another panelist there was Khalid Alexander. He is from Pillars of the Community. And as he described it, his work is largely about advocating for and looking out for policies regarding people who are harmed by law enforcement. And he had a really, I think, good take about what these technologies might mean and how to balance them.
Good job of kind of explaining how these technologies are meant to, are pitched as a solution to problems, as a way of recognizing broken infrastructure that can be fixed. To your point, Jesse, what then happens if you as an individual or you as a community are what's broken and seen as broken from society? What happens when you as an individual are considered your existence in and of itself is considered criminal? And so I think that's what the larger issue with these surveillance technologies are, is that, you know, in Southeast San Diego, if you live in Southeast San Diego, if you're wearing any type of clothes or talking to an individual, you can be documented as a gang member and essentially made into your existence as criminal. If you've come to this country searching for a better way of life and haven't followed whatever, you know, just in order to survive, your very existence is considered criminal. If you're living on the street because you can't afford to live in a home, your existence is seen as criminal. You as a person are seen as something that is broken. And the thing that worried me the most about this technology was it's the potential and actually how we saw the law enforcement begin to use it to identify broken individuals that don't fit under the norm of society. And how then will they begin to target it? And if it was just a question of technology without the biases of the society that we live in, if it was just a question of technology without the biases of the individuals who made those things, that would be a completely different question. But we're talking about giving an enormous amount of power, an enormous amount of authority to who, right? Who has that authority?
I think that's a really clear-eyed way of looking at it, that these, another way to think about it is these technologies are often tools in search of a problem. You don't actually, they're not actually sold to as a clear solution to one thing. They're sold as a tool from which we're going to be able to solve all kinds of things. And what Khalid is saying is the biases of the city about what it views as problems are going to be applied to that technology, and that the biases of the city's view of certain of people from certain areas or certain types of people were in fact applied to that, that same logic was applied to those people just as if they were a potholed street. You know, that they were a problem to be solved.
I liked through the conversation, though, he kept saying, like, look, I can make the balance. I would be against all technology, but I understand that there's a role for technology. Why don't we plan first?
Yeah.
Who's going to be in charge of making some of these decisions when we come to these questions about human and civil rights?
Right. I think if at the beginning it was presented in the way that it was used eventually, I think a lot of questions, really good questions, would have come up, and maybe there would have been some planning. I don't know, but
yeah, I mean, we at least would have had that debate, or it would have been, the answer would have been, let's not use these things.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, but in, later, as we discovered, Jesse discovered, some city council members, including some the two Republicans at the time, had no idea that this was what was the, they were actually implementing.
Right.
What was your pick, Andrea?
My pick was Tuesday's panel, which was about sentencing disparities. And it was really interesting, actually. I think one way we described it was this is such a fire discussion because there were a lot of great points of views in there. But basically, our panelists were talking about some recommendations that recently came out of this committee that was taking a look at the state's criminal law.
So let me just put some context. So we're talking about some people get convicted of crimes and they go to jail or prison for this long, and some people get convicted of crimes and they go to jail for much longer.
Yes.
And
yes,
that everybody seems to acknowledge that happens, and it's what to do about it that we're not sure of.
Right, right. So this committee came up with some recommendations, and the panelists basically said, you know, some of these recommendations are good, but some of them didn't go far enough. And one conversation that was really interesting was by Jay Jordan from Alliance for Safety. He is Alliance for Safety and Justice. He's the vice president. And he mentioned that what some of these people who are making these laws or critics who are criticizing certain laws are Proposition 47, Proposition 57. Proposition 47 made some felonies to misdemeanors, and Proposition 57 gave sentencing credits to people who were participating in some kind of rehabilitation program. And there's a lot of critics saying, well, you're kind of just releasing these individuals back into the public. And he had this really great point about how they're not acknowledging like all these other issues that contribute to why people, you know, may be involved in some kind of life in crime, right? They come from poverty and all these other contributing factors. So I thought that was really interesting.
See, this false dichotomy of this, a victim and offender, right? How somehow, like, you know, these folks don't come from the same neighborhood, sometimes the same household, and they don't want to help each other. So, like, it's always have to be, let's lock people up. Let's give people longer sentences. We know that does not work. Data says putting somebody in a cage, taking them out of their natural environment, and not giving them the rehabilitative things they need does not make community safe.
And so to that point, Dwayne Woodley, assistant district attorney, mentioned that, yes, there are these contributing factors, but one thing we can't forget are victims and the victims left behind these crimes.
For a lot of these crimes, there are victims on the other side of these crimes. And part of the justice system is holding people accountable for their criminal activity, but also making sure that we get justice for our victims. And when we... When victims go into court and a defendant gets sentenced to a certain amount of time, sometimes that gives them a sense of justice. And so when we then change the law, allow them to be released earlier than what the original sentence was, that impacts our victims. And that must be taken into consideration as we analyze these and make these determinations. Not that we haven't over-incarcerated people. I actually agree with that, that we have. But I also want everyone to remember there are victims on the other end of these crimes sometimes who are relying on that sentence for their sense of justice.
That was a good exchange. Yes. Flavor of what you can get in these panels. Okay. Andy, what was yours?
So last night, well, as we're recording this last night, there was a discussion between Aaron Harvey and erstwhile Voice of San Diego editor Sarah Libby about Aaron Harvey's case. Now, if you haven't listened yet, you can hear a lot more about what happened to Aaron Harvey on the first episode of the San Diego 101 podcast. Search for that in your wherever you listen to your podcast, wherever you're listening to this one. But the long and the short of it is that Aaron was one of 14 men arrested in 2014 on a conspiracy charge based on social media posts that the then district attorney, Bonnie DeMonis, alleged proved that not that he had committed murder, but that he was a member of a gang that she suspected was associated with murder. And reacting to outrage over her prosecution and the obscure criminal statute that allowed it, DeMonis had routinely at the time reiterated in the press not that Aaron and his friend Brandon Tiny Doo Duncan had in fact committed the violent crime for which they were facing life in prison, but that they really were gang members, was how she repeatedly justified it, and that the media and the community were naive and stupid for feeling sympathy for them, for being charged with, you know, potentially life in prison, not for committing a crime, but for being in a gang that was alleged to have committed a crime. So Aaron served 7 months in jail for that before a judge dismissed the charges against him. And then earlier this year, he graduated from UC Berkeley. And prior to that, he and Duncan brought a civil suit against the city, arguing that SDPD had wrongly incarcerated them. And last year, the city settled that suit for $1.5 million. And so during this discussion, this is towards the end of the discussion, Sarah's grabbing some questions from the audience.
Can we also say, like, Sarah's piece about this
was
a big deal in that conversation. It changed the whole perspective about what was happening to him. And I think maybe not directly, but certainly changed the circumstances he was dealing with.
Yeah, and Aaron said that last night as well, that sort of the direction of that case changed completely as after Sarah wrote about it. But so this is towards the end of their discussion, and Sarah pulled a question from the chat that was both about the time that he spent in jail and about the settlement that he received last year.
One question is about your settlement with the city. Do you feel like it was able to make up for the harm that the city caused?
If getting back my life, that time, I would get that money back in a second. It's blood money, right? And it's crazy because me and Brandon talk about this to this day, right? That no one's happy about this. Like me and him, like people, it sucks, right? I feel bad because people say congratulations and things like that. And I don't want to be like a Debbie Downer in a sense. Thank you, you know, I appreciate it. But honestly, like, what are you congratulating, right? Like my life was ripped from me. You know, if I would give that money back in a second, if I was able to just kind of get my life back, because again, it's blood money, right? It's like if you have an individual who dies in your family, but then had life insurance, right? And you inherit that, you miss that individual, right? You can care less about the money. And that's how I feel about that, right? There's just certain parts of you that dies when you're sitting in that cell, right? You can go to jail for something you did, and people can live with that. But to go to jail for something that you didn't do, something that they said you didn't do, and then having to, I just remember phone calls with my mother, you know, and having to lie to her, like, oh, we'll be out in a second. Like, this is going to blow over. But then getting off the phone and having to, like, psychologically convince myself that I am going to die in here, right? Because people go crazy in there because they're thinking about what's happening in the outside world, right? I put it in the chat last night, Nicholas Hoskins, we were in the same mob, and he grabbed a sheet and wrapped it around him. his neck and tried to jump off the top tier, and we had to get him, right? People are going through those things. Like, he's going to have to forever live with that. I'm going to have to forever live with seeing that, right? So that part of you never leaves, right? And there's a part of you that is never going to be okay. So it doesn't matter how much money you may or may have not given this. It wasn't worth it.
That part stood out to me because I think it's real easy, based on everything that's happened since 2014, for Aaron and Brandon's story to become apocryphal and to become a discussion about what happened to the law that was used to prosecute them. What he's done with his life since then. He became an organizer and he helped his community in a lot of ways. He graduated from UC Berkeley. It's very inspiring. And it can still be all those things, but it is, I think, important to remember that he spent 7 months in jail. And I think he describes there, in a way, the continued trauma that has had, and that however inspiring his life may have become since then, that is still a thing that happened to him. And, you know, $775,000 or whatever it is he ended up getting in that settlement doesn't make that trauma go away. And I think it's just too easy to distill the situation from as a news story and not as a human tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, three. Yeah, great conversations all around. I'm looking forward to another one tonight with the sheriff's candidates. And then big discussion again about the role or lack of role or needed role or whatever for police on the streets with homelessness and homeless encampment. So that's going to be a good discussion led by Lisa Halberstadt tomorrow night, Friday night. So if you're listening to this Friday afternoon, you still have time. And we'll be rounding up the best we can and following up some of these points over the next few days. Andre, quite a couple of weeks for you to start.
It's been fun.
Yeah.
It's been wild.
Jumped right into some heady and difficult investigative work, some big events, big conversations, tough decisions. You all good? We're set?
I'm good. I have coffee, good people.
All right.
That's good.
That's all we need. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in this little part of downtown San Diego. Speaking of great podcasts, you really do need to check out San Diego 101. You now have 2 episodes of that show in your feed right now. The most recent one dropped on Tuesday, Who Polices the Police? It's good. It's the only podcast like it in San Diego. Share it with your friends. All right, I'm Scott Lewis, editor-in-chief at Voice San Diego. Andrew Keats and Andrea Lopez Villafana are our managing editors. This show is produced by Nate John, Adriana Hildes, and Megan Wood. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week.